Alors, bonjour, bonsoir et bienvenue. Bienvenue à l'Université McGill. Je suis Antonia Mayoni, la directrice de l'Institut des études canadiennes de l'Université McGill. And I'd like to welcome you all here tonight for the 2011 James R. Mallory Lecture in Canadian Studies. I'd like to especially acknowledge the students of Political Science 222, also known as Political Process and Behavior in Canada, who are just a small part of the terrific cohort of undergraduates we have here at McGill University. Le doyen, M. Manfredi, va vous parler un peu plus en détail du discours Mallory et du professeur Mallory lui-même dans un petit moment. Mais j'aimerais surtout maintenant signaler que la présentation de Andrew Cohen fait partie d'une étude plus large des relations canado-américaines sur laquelle on penche cette année à l'Institut. In fact, this year, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada will hold its annual conference on the theme of the Canada-U.S. relationship, scheduled for March 24th and 25th, so you can mark your calendars and iPhones and Blackberries now. The conference is entitled Canada and the United States, Conversations and Relations. And it will include a series of small panel interviews between Canadian and American counterparts about particular aspects of one of the world's most long-standing relationships. For example, one of the discussions will be between the Canadian ambassador to the U.S., Gary Doer, and the U.S. ambassador to Canada, His Excellency David Johnson. And as it so happens, we are very happy to welcome Ambassador Jacobson to McGill this evening. As many of you know, Ambassador Jacobson is now a fixture in Ottawa, but he was only sworn in as U.S. Ambassador on September 25, 2009. Before serving in the White House, he spent his career in the law and litigation, and before that earned a J.D. from Georgetown and a B.A. from Johns Hopkins University. Ambassador Jacobson honored us in November by delivering the Fulbright Lecture. He is here this evening in a much less formal way and has agreed to say a few words before Andrew Cohen's presentation. Votre Excellence.
Antonia, thank you very much. It is great to be back here in Montreal, and particularly great to be here at McGill. As Antonia said, I was in this very room a few months ago to give the Fulbright Lecture, and I'm here tonight to join you in listening to my dear friend Andrew Cohen give the Mallory Lecture. Now, there are a lot of reasons for me to visit Montreal, the hockey, the poutine, but the best reason truly is my coming here to McGill. I love this place so much that, as you heard, my son goes here. And he loves it so much that he's home studying tonight. So I appreciate that as well. We're here tonight for the Mallory Lecture. That was established back in 1995 to honor J.R. Mallory. As a former political science student myself, I wish that I had had the opportunity to hear Professor Mallory in his lectures here at McGill. But through this lecture series, we're all in some very real way his continuing students. And I give thanks to his family that's here joining us tonight, and to McGill for continuing his legacy for a new generation of students. Your speaker tonight, Andrew Cohen, and his family have become dear friends of mine and of my family since I arrived here in Canada. Mary, it's great to see you here. Andrew has taught me everything I know about Canadian politics and Canadian history. But the family member who has really taught my family the most is their son, Alex. Alex has taught my wife everything there is to know about collecting and trading those little Olympic pins that were so much the rage in Vancouver. He really is an exceptional kid, and all of you folks at McGill should be recruiting him and recruiting him very hard. I met Andrew before I came to Canada. One of the things that the State Department does is to prepare new ambassadors is they bring together groups of outside third-party experts to brief incoming ambassadors about their host countries. And the person who was clearly in that group the most expert, the most interesting, and the most personable was Andrew Cohn. I have since then sat at his feet. He has taught me most everything I know about the relationship between the United States and Canada. And what that means is that whenever I make a mistake, it's his fault. Folks, you're in for a treat. Andrew has forgotten more about this relationship than I will probably ever know. I can't wait to learn more tonight, and I thank you very much for having me here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Jacobson. Most of you probably know Andrew Cohn as one of Canada's most distinguished nonfiction authors and career journalist, media personality who appears frequently on television and radio as a commentator on history, citizenship, and politics. Andrew Cohn is also a devoted teacher and a mentor as a professor in the School of Journalism and Communications at Carleton University and an active commentator with a syndicated column for Post Media newspapers and, until last fall, the founding president of the Historical Dominion Institute in Toronto. But the most important thing about Andrew is that he's from Montreal. And he's a graduate of McGill University, where he studied political science as an undergraduate. So all of it is coming together now about why he is our Mallory lecturer for 2011. He also went on to earn graduate degrees in journalism at Carleton University and has been a visiting fellow at Cambridge University as well. Andrew's experience, unlike all of the journalists that we see today, is both broad and deep. He entered journalism in 1977 the way most people did back then, as a copy boy with the Weekend Ottawa Citizen, but within 3 years he was covering everything from education to police matters to municipal politics. In 1980 he joined United Press International, another bygone era, as a parliamentary correspondent, and by 1983 he had been seconded to Washington as editor of the UPI's Foreign Desk. In the next decade, Andrew Cohn's byline became a household name in Canada with the Financial Post, from his coverage of political events to foreign and national affairs columnist, as well as writing one of the most interesting studies of the Meech Lake debacle. He joined the editorial board of the Globe and Mail in 1994 and lost no time in racking up just about every journalism award that Canada has to offer. He spent 4 critical years in Washington in the late 1990s as the Globe and Mail's bureau chief there, covering Bill Clinton's impeachment trial and the disputed 2000 elections. His contributions to Canadian nonfiction are second to none, prompting the New York Times to call Andrew Cohn one of Canada's most distinguished authors. Among his best-selling books are While Canada Slept, How We Lost Our Place in the World, which was a finalist for the Governor General's Literary Award, The Unfinished Canadian, The People We Are, and most recently, Extraordinary Canadians, Lester B. Pearson. By the way, Andrew, we assigned one of your books for a very large lecture class here at McGill. It's more than 100 students, so somebody owes somebody a drink. For some special reason, my path has fortunately crossed with Andrew Cohn in a variety of settings. Most important for me, in terms of the collegial relationship we have developed as members of the Banff Forum Policy Group and as mentors with the Action Canada Leadership Program. We also share an alma mater, not McGill, but rather the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs. And I have learned from him, most importantly, as a role model in his dedication to Canada's past, present, and future. He's an exceptional writer, an exceptional author, and I thank him on a very personal note for accepting our invitation here this evening. Andrew.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to return to McGill University. As Anthony said, I'm a graduate of this institution, as was virtually everyone else in my family, my father, his 2 sisters, his brother, his father, his mother, my two sisters, many of my cousins, and many of my friends. My mother and my sister, and I think my brother-in-law, my wife, are here today. My wife didn't go to McGill, but I think fears our children might. But it's always a pleasure to be back in Montreal. As Leonard Cohen said early in his career, he always liked to play Montreal because he knew if no one else showed up, his family would. And you should know I feel the same way. I wanted to thank Ambassador Jacobson for being here this afternoon particularly. Since he arrived in Canada in 2009, he and his wife Julie have become wonderful friends of ours. He's a superb representative of his country in what is the most important diplomatic post in Ottawa. He knows everyone, he's been everywhere, and he comports himself with extraordinary professionalism. When I first met him, and he's referred to that, knowing about his role and his interest in politics, I couldn't resist asking him about politics at home. Now, you know the ambassador is a man of great optimism, and his answer to me was always the same, regardless of the polls, things would work out well for the Democrats. And, you know, and truth be told, as a 17-year-old who had worked for George McGovern in New Hampshire and Connecticut in 1972, that's what I always wanted to hear. So last January, when things were looking bad for the Democrats trying to hold the late Ted Kennedy's Senate seat in Massachusetts, I asked the ambassador who would win. "Don't worry, no problem, it's in the bag, I'll bet you lunch." Well, I didn't take the bet, though I should have, the Democrats lost. Last October, I began to worry about the Democrats in Congress. I asked the ambassador, "Of course, no problem, don't worry, Democrats will hold the House." This time there was no offer of a bet for lunch. Well, we know what happened. So now it's 2011, and we're entering a new presidential cycle. And I'm hoping, I don't mind saying, for the re-election of the president next year. But truth be told, I've not yet asked the ambassador what he thinks, because I know what he'll tell me. "Don't worry, no problem, it's in the bag." And that, ladies and gentlemen, is when I'm really going to worry about the re-election of Barack Obama. One other acknowledgement, and that, of course, is to my friend, Antonia Maione. We've known each other for, I think it must be 10 or 15 years now. Our paths cross in the work we do, as she said, at the Bound Forum in Action Canada. She's really one of the most astute commentators in Canada in three languages on so many issues and has skillfully led the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada from success to success. She's stepping down, I think, this year to focus on teaching and research, and the Institute will miss her. And lastly, by way of introductory comments, this lecture. I studied political science when I was here, but my discipline wasn't Canadian government. It was international affairs, with some political theory thrown in for gravitas. My mentors in the department were Janice Stein, whom I still know very well, Blima Steinberg, Baldev Raj Nayar, as well as Hal Waller, Paul Noble, and Charles Taylor. But we all knew Professor Mallory as a titan in his field, and I well remember my classmates carrying around his book, The Structure of Canadian Government. In those days, I confess I knew it only by its cover, which I recall was brown. But I remember it as being the definitive text, almost biblical in its reputation. By my count, this is the 18th J.R. Mallory lecture in Canadian Studies. I've been preceded here, among others, by Chantal Hébert, Roch Carrier, Graham Fraser, Phyllis Lambert, Bob Ray, and J.R. Mallory himself, who gave the inaugural lecture, I think, in the early 1990s. It's an honor to be in their company. Now, I'm under strict instructions not to go on too long today, and I promise you I won't. I was asked to speak this year about Canada and the United States, and I'll spare you a discussion of trade or a meditation on the border or a poem to the perimeter, as in security perimeter. That's the mechanics of our long and enduring relationship best left to the practitioners. I'd like to step back and reflect on Canadians and Americans, two peoples sharing the same continent, the same fundamental values, the same aspirations, even as they may be divided, as George Bernard Shaw said of the British and the Americans, by a common language. John Kennedy famously said that geography has made us neighbors, history has made us friends, economics has made us partners, and necessity has made us allies. We are neighbors, we are friends, and we are partners, all true. But while geography was inescapable, our history could have been different. It wasn't inevitable that things have turned out as they have. Indeed, It could have gone another way. It could have gone sour, but it didn't, and we should understand and celebrate that. So today, let's discuss who we are, Americans and Canadians, the tenants of the upper and lower half of North America, and where we are in the second decade of the 21st century. I'll offer you some observations on character, a character which in recent years, I believe, is converging. And I say this knowing that many Canadians on this side of the border believe that we are very different peoples, a sense reinforced when we watch bad things happen in the United States, like the murders in Tucson 10 days ago, and assure ourselves that that can't happen here. And that, in a sense, is the thesis of Fire and Ice, a book published in 2003 by Michael Adams, the pollster. It argues that in many ways we are diverging. Not for him the old soothing orthodoxy that the border is an artificial separation of two peoples of similar instinct, imagination, and ideals. His view, based on polling 10 and 15 years ago, before September the 11th, is that we're drifting apart and becoming less and less like each other. As he sees it, Americans do not live as enlightened, progressive, and wholesome as existence as Canadians, who are more tolerant of diversity, for example. Personally, I don't believe it. In many ways, I think we are quite similar and becoming more so, particularly in how we live, how we think, and how we act. Some of this is on account of how we have changed. Some is on the account of how Americans have changed. And if we are drawing closer in attitude and habits of mind, we might ask what it means for identity as Canadians, living as we do in the shadow of the American colossus, still some 10 times our size. Well, let me begin with this. In November 2009, some 15 months ago, the Historic Dominion Institute commissioned a poll on the first anniversary of the election of Barack Obama. We wanted to know how Canadians felt about the United States a year after the election of the new president. Our expectation was that we would see a more favorable view of the country than we had in a poll done in 2005, asking pretty much the same questions when George W. Bush was beginning his second term as president. We expected a more generous view of America because George W. Bush was very unpopular in Canada in 2005, and Barack Obama was very popular in Canada in 2009. Surely we assumed that would color our larger view of the Americans. Well, what did we find? Well, we found, yes, that Barack Obama was dramatically more popular than George Bush. Some 86% of Canadians felt that Barack Obama felt warmly and enthusiastically about Barack Obama, and only 21% felt that way about George W. Bush in 2005. But for all that, Canadians felt only slightly more inclined toward the United States than they did in the poll 4 years earlier. We, like other observers, had assumed that Barack Obama's election would erode an enduring distrust of the United States and Canada. Actually, it appeared to have done little to change deep-seated attitudes. What's striking about the findings is how Canadians have detached their personal view of Barack Obama, whom they like and respect, from the United States, which they view with more skepticism, I would say, than affection. When we asked if they feel at home whenever they visit the United States, only 48% of Canadians agreed in 2009. 4 years earlier, 44% had agreed. When we asked, in addition, regardless of whether Bush or Obama was in the White House, Canadians did not think our values were becoming more or less like those of the United States. In fact, most Canadians, 52%, thought American and Canadian values were staying just about the same, in contrast to 45% under George Bush 4 years earlier. One other telling number, Canadians were split on whether the United States is a force for good in the world. While 44% agreed, 46% disagreed. In Quebec, incidentally, under a third, 32%, thought the United States is a force for good in the world, reflecting presumably a more pronounced opposition here to America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, this is one poll with the usual caveats, but it is revealing. What is important to know is that whether George W. Bush or Barack Obama is president, we still like the American people. But we don't feel at home among them, as if America really were a foreign land, and we don't think America, according to this poll, is a force for good in the world, as if the United States did not share many of our international interests. And that was surprising to me. Now, there may be reasons we don't feel at home in America, much as we like to visit, study, and work there. After all, there is much that is different about them and us, and it isn't just geography. In many areas, such as religion and guns, it is absolutely true that we are not like the Americans. But in a number of ways, I would say, we are becoming more like them. Many of the myths that we have had about the United States and about ourselves are beginning to erode. In some cases, we deny our similarities because we need to feel distinct to survive. It's not surprising for a small people living in the shadow of a big people to feel a deep, visceral need to distinguish between us and them, and we do. So here are some four myths about the Americans, which I suggest are no longer true. Obesity. There was a time when Canadians took some satisfaction in the notion that we were skinny and they were fat. We liked the caricature of the American who couldn't fit into the seat on the airplane next to you because, well, he needed two seats. The American was overweight because food is cheap, appetites are large, portions are huge, and gratification is encouraged in the United States of America. If everything isn't bigger in America, as they say in West Side Story, if everything isn't better in America, as they say in West Side Story, surely everything is bigger in America. Just the other day, I noted that Starbucks has introduced an even bigger cup for its cold drinks in the United States. It seems to hold about a gallon. Now, being skinny, a shorthand for being fit, appealed to our sense of well-being and self-image in Canada. If that was ever true, it isn't anymore. In case you haven't heard, obesity is an epidemic in Canada, particularly among children. Our rates of obesity are not yet those in the United States, but they are not far from those in the United States. In 2005, we were the fifth most overweight or obese nation in the world. The United States was the first. Half of us, 2 years ago, were said to be overweight or obese. In the United States, it's two-thirds. By another measure, more recent, 60% of Canadians are overweight. So what this suggests is they're very close now. It is now entering, this problem, our public consciousness. Last week, the CBC National ran a week-long series on fitness. This week, it's the Globe and Mail. The Great Weight Debate, it's called. Not long ago, the Ottawa Citizen, the paper I write for, editorialized, it's becoming harder and harder to be self-righteous and denigrate the Americans for their supersized lifestyle, a lifestyle we evidently share. Frugality. There was a time Canadians took satisfaction in the notion that we were savers and they were spenders. Put differently, we were careful, judicious, and restrained with money. They were extravagant, careless, and wanton with money. We saved, they spent, we were misers, they were spendthrifts. To a degree, some of that is true today. The reason our banks are now called the savers in the world is that they are conservative in how they lend money. It's harder to buy a home here, and becoming more so. We cannot deduct the interest on our mortgage from our income tax, and we do not have as generous terms. It is one of the reasons we don't have the same rates of foreclosure. So we're frugal, right? Isn't that what we think of ourselves? Well, wrong, actually. We're no longer frugal. Listen to the governor of the Bank of Canada raising the alarm about household debt. Quote, "This cannot continue," Mark Carney said on September the 30th. "While asset prices can rise or fall, debt endures." On December 17th, he said, "Experience suggests that prolonged periods of unusually low rates can cloud assessments of financial risk. Low rates today do not necessarily mean low rates tomorrow. Risk reversals, when they happen, can be fierce. The greater the complacency, the more brutal the reckoning." He joins others in this chorus, including the Minister of Finance, in warning us in Canada that we're living beyond our means. It seems that we, too, want all those things of the consumer society. Big screen televisions, SUVs, winter vacations, and we're prepared to get them on borrowed money. At the end of 2009, our household debt was a record $1.41 trillion. At the end of 2009, that was about $96,000 per household. Our debt-to-asset ratio was the highest in the OECD, and Canada's debt-to-income ratio reached a record high of 146% last year. We have heard much about the perils of American debt, and in terms of government, I hasten to note that our fiscal picture, that is, national debt and budgetary deficit, is far healthier than that of the Americans or the Europeans. We are not Britain, Ireland, or Greece. But while it may be comforting to think of ourselves as more virtuous, it isn't consistently so. At the same time, we're not saving as much as we did. It's interesting to know that in 2004, things changed markedly in Canada. The personal savings rate here fell below 1%, actually negative half a percent, the first time it had fallen below zero since Ottawa began collecting these figures in 1961. Our savings rate was below that of the United States as well. And since then, on account of the recession, they're now very close, the United States and Canada. But we are no longer the savers we were at the rate we were. Our inclination to spend rather than save is why the federal government moved yesterday to toughen rules on mortgages. It cut the maximum amortization period from 35 to 30 years. It lowered the maximum amount that Canadians can borrow against the value of their home to 85% from 90%. And it removed federal support for home equity lines of credit. This is the second time the government has acted. It implemented a first round of measures about a year ago. It is also worrying about our exposure. It knows that when interest rates rise, as they surely will, many Canadian homeowners will be unable to sustain their mortgages. Canada will face its own foreclosure crisis and the reckoning Mark Carney fears. One other thing while we're talking about money, and that's income distribution. We've always seen ourselves as a more equitable country in which we distribute wealth through generous social programs. In large measure, we do that. In the United States, we note that 1% of the wealth is concentrated. 1% of the population has about 25% of the wealth, a figure which has tripled since 1978. In Canada, a kinder and gentler place, the top 1% controls 17% of the wealth, a figure which has doubled since 1978. So once again, the gap isn't what we think it is. Criminality. Another of our boasts is that Canada has low crime, and by and large this is true, although if you believe the Conservatives, it isn't true, which is why they're building prisons. And hard though it may be to believe, it is also true of the United States. While many of us still believe that American cities are combat zones, it is no longer so. The rate of violent crime in American cities is now dropping to levels unseen since the 1960s when they were relatively low. As for crime rates generally, some argue that ours is now very much the same as theirs, although criminologists do argue. Rest assured, we're still entitled to our mythologies. It's still safe to watch The Sopranos and cringe or worry about walking on the southeast side of Washington. But it isn't as dangerous as it was. On crime, that is street crime, and not political violence I'll address later, our image of the embattled American cowering behind locked doors is no longer so. Though those doors remain locked, as they do in Canada, whatever Michael Moore, the filmmaker, may say about the homes in Windsor, Ontario. In dealing with violent crime, one of the biggest changes in the United States is the approach to capital punishment. We imprisoned our killers, they put them to death. In this case, the states did murder, that is, the state are responsible for sentencing and carrying out executions. That was so until we abolished the death penalty in Canada in 1976. Our last execution, incidentally, was in 1962. In the United States, where capital punishment is a state responsibility, many states, of course, did murder. And for years, our approach to the death penalty on either side of the border has been a demarcation of our two societies. But something extraordinary has happened over the last 10 years in the United States. Some states have abolished the death penalty. Some have simply stopped using it. All told, the number of people executed in the United States is more than half of what it was 10 years ago. Last year alone, the use of the death penalty fell 12%. 12 of 53 jurisdictions carried out executions. 15 of 50 states don't have the death penalty. Just last week, Illinois became another, which moved to abolish capital punishment. California, a state larger in population than Canada, has not had an execution in 5 years. In November, elected a governor and attorney general who opposed the death penalty. In the United States as a whole, the rate of execution is now the lowest since the death penalty was restored in 1976. Now, Texas still kills people. When I visited death row in Huntsville, Texas, in 2000, they were killing about 440 people a year. I was sent there because my newspaper, the Globe and Mail, considered killing a contagion, and they wanted a Canadian view of this. The year before, they had put 35 convicts to death. Last year, by contrast, it was 17, which was about 30% fewer than the year before. This suggests, I would suggest to you, an America moving away from capital punishment, and there are reasons for this, such as DNA testing. And America, I would say, with a view closer to this, or moving closer to Canada. The United States now ranks some 24th in the world in murders per capita. Canada ranks 44th. One other area, ethnicity. In Canada, we've seen ourselves as a mosaic. That is to say, immigrants come here and are free to remain who they are without pressure to conform. We're proud of this, though I sometimes wonder why, as it leads to me, to a fragmented, balkanized country. In the United States, they're the melting pot in which immigrants come and adopt the norms, values, and traditions and cultures of the majority. As we see it, we offer newcomers independence and they demand conformity. But if that were so, and I don't think it really ever was so in the United States, it is no longer so. Consider Hispanic America. So separate is the Spanish community in the United States that increasingly, I'd suggest, Spanish is becoming to America what French is to Canada. In 2009, there were 48.4 million Hispanic Americans, 16% of the population. They are now the largest minority in America and the fastest growing. 35 million Hispanic Americans over 5 speak Spanish at home. Half are said to speak English very well, which suggests the other half do not speak English very well, hindering the traditional view of assimilation. There are projected to be 132 million Hispanic Americans by 2050, representing a third of the American population at that time. So if this is a melting pot where people jump in on arrival and emerge red-blooded Americans, it isn't looking like a pot and it isn't melting. According to figures, as we have assimilated people in Canada, so have the Americans at roughly the same level. And as some here question multiculturalism, so do some in the United States. As far back as 1992, Arthur Schlesinger, the historian and liberal, raised the alarm in his book, The Disuniting of America, Reflections on a Multicultural Society. He lamented what he called identity politics and the rise of ethnic interests, undermining the civic virtues which have kept the nation together. Well, sound familiar? It's a debate not dissimilar to one we are having in Canada. Here, then, are just a handful of ways in which our two peoples are more alike than we thought. We Canadians are becoming bigger in appearance and more profligate in spending and borrowing. Those Americans are safer in their cities, like we are, and more ethnic or Hispanic in their composition. As for defining America in that way, as French Canada has so often defined us. Moreover, Americans are not using capital punishment as often as they did. It makes for two peoples less different than many of us would imagine or admit. On other social touchstone issues, homosexuality, divorce, abortion, I think it's pretty safe to say that Canada remains decidedly more liberal. But here, too, the United States may be changing. The Defense of Marriage Act of 1996, which defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman, is being challenged in the courts. Gay marriage is legal in a few states, although illegal in most. Divorce is now no fault in all 50 states. Abortion remains contentious, but it is here, too. As a woman cannot get an abortion in some parts of America, that is true of some jurisdictions in Canada. In politics, there is also a curious convergence between our two countries. In Canada, 8 provinces and territories and the federal government have now adopted fixed election dates. This has happened in the last decade. In the Senate, the government remains committed to an elected, not appointed body of fixed terms. This government has also introduced parliamentary review of its appointments to the Supreme Court, which don't mean much really, but tries to, in a sense, copy the process in the United States, where senior judicial, diplomatic, cabinet, and other presidential appointments must be approved by the United States Senate. One of our provinces, British Columbia, has embraced petition and recall, like some American states. All these might be considered American ideas. And of course, the most American idea in our country, without doubt, is the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which we adopted after a long acrimonious debate in 1982. Its critics will still say to you that we've imported something foreign and grafted it, like a skin, on our parliamentary system. Canadians, though, are now aggressively asserting their rights, making Canada a more litigious society in which the courts have become ascendant. The Charter has become a touchstone of our identity, polls show, in which Canadians take enormous pride, much like the wilderness, hockey, and peacekeeping. Another convergence. While our discourse has not degenerated into the acrimonious wail it has in America, we can say with some confidence that it has coarsened in Canada. All you have to do is watch Question Period, and you realize why there's a move afoot to restore civility to the House of Commons. We are not yet yelling liar when our Prime Minister offers a ceremonial address, as one legislator did when Barack Obama was delivering the State of the Union address, but parliamentarians yell lots of other things during other speeches. As we have a more fractious politics, we now have attack ads. Just look at what the Conservatives did to Stephane Dion and what they're trying to do to Michael Ignatieff, who is just visiting Canada after, by the way, 5 years in Parliament, longer than either Pierre Trudeau or Brian Mulroney spent before they were elected Prime Minister. Or more recently, just yesterday or today, they've released more ads. One of them is, he didn't come back for you, meaning he left Harvard, but I guess he hasn't returned yet. And for that matter, by the way, some of the advertising the Liberals have used against the Conservatives, there was one particularly in 2006 about soldiers in the streets, which was not terribly effective. But the Conservatives are quite happy, for example, to portray coalition government as unconstitutional, un-Canadian, and unseemly, as if it had never happened before in Canada, which it absolutely has. That, I imagine, will become a harder argument to make now that Great Britain and Australia have adopted coalitions. But this is what happens to the national conversation: sophistry, falsehood, drive-by smears. Unless you wonder about its origin or where it seemed to come from, just listen to two of the major parties and what they said in response to those attack ads in the last 24 hours. Gilles Duceppe said yesterday, of the Conservatives, there is always this demagogic side to them. The inspiration comes from the American Republicans in always trying to divide. And the Liberals, this is more of the same mud and invective we've come to expect from Harper, dividing Canadians with Republican-style personal attacks and fabricated claims. In other words, they say we're importing this kind of thing from the United States, and I don't think they collaborated on their statements yesterday. So this is where we in Canada have gone. But what about the Americans? For years, if you ask a Canadian the most single Canadian thing about us, he might say healthcare. We were justly proud of healthcare, which we introduced in 1968, following its success in Saskatchewan. In North America, it was ours alone. It gave us bragging rights and a monopoly here on empathy, or so we thought. Now, of course, the United States has joined at least the 20th century and embraced a form of healthcare. It isn't our system of mandatory coverage and universal access or that of the Europeans, but it will extend coverage to many people who do not have it, millions actually, and it is a significant first step. And yes, it was and remains highly contentious in the United States. Many Democrats lost their seats because they supported it, and their party may well have lost the House of Representatives and nearly the Senate because of it. The town hall meetings in the summer of 2009 were acrimonious. Canada, you should note, was often the whipping boy. Indeed, as American style has become a default term for nationalists and anti-Americans to describe anything bad from the South, so now is Canadian style when it comes to slagging health care in America. We should remember that we, too, had a passionate debate when Medicare came to Saskatchewan. There was a long doctor strike in Saskatchewan. Though, of course, nothing like the American debate. And even today, months after the bill became law, the House of Representatives, now controlled by the Republican, debates its repeal. That may even be happening today. But if health care sticks, and if it is expanded, it will represent, I suggest, a little more of the liberalization of America. The word socialism, a la Canada, has also appeared in the American vocabulary when the government bailed out the banks and the car companies about a year and a half ago, just as we did, by the way. Of course, President Obama is called a socialist all the time, and it isn't a compliment. Again, though, the expansion of government to address the exigencies of the financial crisis is an example of the power of the state to intervene in the economy, with which we're well familiar in Canada. So if I may say, there's something of evolution here. In Canada, in many ways, we become like Americans in how we look, spend, and behave. Meanwhile, we adopt some of their political mores and practices, such as fixed election dates. I would call this the Americanization of Canada. In the United States, they become like us in the growth of government, the expansion of the state, in their falling crime, and most pointedly, the adoption of health care, limited as it is. This I would call, in a more modest way, the Canadianization of America. Now, I don't mean to argue today that there are no differences between Canadians and Americans. Of course there are. We do not have a history of violence. We do not have a gun culture. We don't kill our leaders, as they do in the United States. Religion does not have the same resonance in Canada. And the influence of evangelism is far less. Our media is less politicized and contentious. I would say, on the whole, we're more moderate. Yet even here, we should be careful about being smug, which comes, I think, pretty easily to us. Dean Acheson, the former Secretary of State and statesman, who was married, by the way, to a Canadian, and knew Canada very well, once wrote an essay called Canada, Stern Daughter of the Voice of God. He was wary of Canadian sanctimony. There are, though, more and more shadings, I think, of America and Canada. We don't have a gun culture, but we do have gun violence, much of it here in Quebec, I'm ashamed to say, frankly, whether it was an attack on the National Assembly or the shootings at Dawson College or the massacre at École Polytechnique in 1989, or the murder of the four Mounties in Alberta. It can happen here, as can more general social unrest, such as riots in the streets of Montreal or Calgary after hockey games go the wrong way, or sometimes when they go the right way. Religion is not the same here in Canada, but to read Marcy MacDonald, the author and journalist who wrote The Armageddon Factor last year, there has been a sharp growth in the religious right in Canada. She says it can and is happening here. Perhaps so. Our media is not as shallow and divisive as the American, but give it time. As a broadcast, the National remains strong, but it has gone, I think, very soft. We don't mind giving a rube like Don Cherry, with views as loud and discordant as his jackets, a national platform, or inviting him into the City Council in Toronto, where he presided over a civic ceremony. You'll recall the debate over Sun Television as Fox News North. I don't think shouting and polemic will work here, but rest assured, they'll give it a try. Our politics have yet to produce a Sarah Palin, and Peggy Wente writes in the Globe, our distaste for her reflects a reassuring condescension among us. I'm not sure. Personally, I think we just don't like a shallow, self-aggrandizing, untutored opportunist who thinks she should be president. And while Mayor Rob Ford of Toronto is no Sarah Palin, no one thought he could get elected, and he did. My point here is not to deny the differences. They're real. They exist. It is, though, to show that differences are not as sharp and distinct as we think, or perhaps we desire. They are, in that telling phrase, in the narcissism of small differences, which a people like us finds to differentiate ourselves from people like them. It is hard for us to accept that we're becoming more alike, especially after the horror of Tucson, even if alike means in some ways respecting and entrenching human rights. To be too similar is to reinforce doubts, lingering doubts, enduring doubts of our identity. After all, if we're not American, some would ask, what are we? What happens when they come to look more like us and we like them? Where does that leave us? We already know, we have long known, that we share a belief in democracy, freedom and human rights, the market economy and the uses of government, with, of course, divisions in between us. We favor good, honest government, and we've had that regardless of the party in power. We're not Argentina, which was as wealthy as we were in 1900, but followed a path of authoritarianism and corruption. We believe, both the United States and Canada, in immigration and pluralism. We believe in peace and security. Those are a given. But take away health care, or a view of multiculturalism, and other cherished touchstones of identity, and what's left for us and between us? Winter, well, yes, but it's threatened by global warming. Peacekeeping, well, we don't do it anymore. Hockey, well, yes, but our dominance is threatened by the Americans, some 150 of whom now play in the National Hockey League. When I was a child, you could count them on one hand. And did they not take us into overtime at the last Olympics? Ambassador Jacobson, of course, will remember that one well. So what's left? Maple syrup, the inflection A? I jest, of course, but those who continue to define this country only in counter-distinction to the United States, for them a converging character is a big problem. Our changing attitudes, preferences, inclinations, and habits of mind are enough to create an existential crisis. We have Medicare, therefore we are. So what happens when their system looks like ours, which it might one day, particularly as we embrace private care and clinics, and suddenly we lose our corner on compassion in this neighborhood? Now, some may lose sleep over this continental character. I don't. If we've learned anything over the last generation, it's that Canadians have developed a strong self-confidence, even if we don't always recognize it. It is reflected not just in sports, of which our excellence in hockey is one, but in creating a decent society supported by an economy managed prudently, fostering a distinctive culture in art, music, and literature. There remains here a social contract. As someone has once said, it's better to be rich in the United States than Canada, we know, and it's still better to be poor in Canada than in the United States. We still do things here largely by consensus, which is why health care wasn't repealed when the Conservatives followed the Liberals into office, and why we've lost fewer than 100 lives in our entire history to domestic rebellion, insurrection, or assassination. Consensus and moderation is why we remain committed to open immigration, regardless of the government in Ottawa, in a country where not one of the four major political parties is nativist or anti-foreign, unlike virtually every other country in Europe which has such political parties. Or why we continue to expand the national park system, one actually the unsung achievements of the Harper government, or why we still have a foreign policy which values the United Nations, though clearly not enough, which is perhaps why we didn't win our traditional seat on the Security Council last autumn. Of all this, we should be proud. And at the same time, we should thank our lucky stars that we live in North America. Not only because it's big, secure, isolated, and rich in resources and virtually everything else the world needs, but because in the great lottery in the sky, we landed beside the United States of America. We got one neighbor, not several like Germany, Austria, or Russia, and we've gotten along pretty well. Think about that for a moment. China fought with India and Japan. Germany fought with Poland and a whole bunch of other people. Poland, which fought with Russia. France fought with England and Spain. We could go on about the rivals and resentments which tore apart Europe for centuries, or Asia, or Latin America. As for us, we went to war in 1812, but since then, we pretty much haven't bothered each other. We can argue over who actually won that war, and next year we will. But not that it fostered 200 years of peace, a remarkably enduring peace over two centuries, the last of which was the bloodiest in the history of the world. And yes, while we can no longer boast of the longest undefended border in the world, it is still unmatched anywhere. In Americans, we lucked out. We landed beside a people who've given the world all manner of things, scientific, cultural, and industrial, who, whatever their pathologies, excesses, and impulses, who have not turned on us in anger or aggression or envy. We fought with them twice through to victory, successfully. When we didn't join them in their foreign adventures in Vietnam and Iraq, they did not isolate or punish us. When we went our own way in Cuba, on Cuba and China, they frowned, and eventually in recognizing China, they followed us, as they will eventually in recognizing Cuba. By the way, watch for that, incidentally, if Barack Obama is reelected. They buy three-quarters, or thereabouts, of what we make, and they don't complain that the surplus is in our favor. When they talk about protectionism, it hardly matters. It covers so little of the record amount of trade that crosses our border every day. We dodge buy American. I apologize here if I sound like Ambassador Dewar or Ambassador Jacobson, but the figures are true, and by international standards, unprecedented. In short, given their size and the reach of their empire, Americans have not just been our neighbors, they have been our friends, our partners, and our allies. Had we landed somewhere else in the world, beside someone else, it might have been entirely different. We might not have become the people we are, free to make choices, free to say no, free even to contract out our defense to the Americans so we could invest in our social programs like Medicare, which makes us feel proud and sometimes superior on the subsidy the Americans provided. So let's not worry about our emerging, converging continental character. I suggest we relax about it. Fundamentally, we will remain who we are, and they will remain who they are, and they won't overwhelm us, and surely we won't overwhelm them. As free trade did not mean the end of our national identity, neither will any other economic or political configuration we create. We will talk about new arrangements this year or next year, this decade or next, because the world is sewing itself together, and we will have to as well on this continent. When it is harder to get from Dundas, Ontario to Detroit, Michigan than it is to get from Berlin to Warsaw, I think we have a problem in North America. Whatever political arrangements we make or yet make to make this continent work, whether it's a customs union or a single currency or a supranational parliament, we in Canada can make them knowing that it will enhance our nation and not threaten it. We've grown up. We've shed our adolescent fears. Our sovereignty today is not only economic, political, territorial. It's the sovereignty of the mind. We are Canadians, and finally, please, let us hope that means something more than being not Americans. After 144 years as a nation, we know who we are. We are here to stay, and we know that living next to the Americans was, is, and will continue to be a benefit of geography and a blessing of history. Thank you.
moment, but before that, Professor Cohen has graciously accepted to answer questions, so I hope you've heard it.
I guess I have.
So we have a mic in the middle of the room. We have the overflow audience. This is Andrew in the other room. So if anyone would like to ask a question, I just want to remind the room that we normally allow the first question to reveal the student. So if any of the students would like to ask a question, you guys get the first dibs at asking the question of our student.
All of them are forced to be here.
Yeah, hi. I'm just curious, what do you take about the American approach in foreign policy for being so unilateral and Canada being so much more multilateral, for instance? Like, what do you think about the differences between those?
Well, I think Americans were more unilateral under George W. Bush than they are under Barack Obama. I think there's a renewed belief in the United Nations in Washington. I think the president's comments into the Muslim world early on in his administration and other overtures in other places suggest America, which believes it can't go it alone the way it has for so long. I think there's been a change, a shift. And I think Secretary Clinton embodies that in the kind of language that's being used in around the world today. So we have always looked to multilateralism as a counterweight to the influence of the United States, and we still do. But I don't think the United States is as unilateral as it was. Well, some would argue the indicators don't, but I am that they are. Insecurity, I think that it's been part of our, you know, we've lasted here a long time under unlikely circumstances. I mean, we got the upper half of the continent, which is for the most part less attractive than the southern part of the continent. And against the odds, we have made it here. But I think part of that has always been, and naturally so, a anxiety about our pulling it through. And by the way, when you have, aside from all the other elements, when you have one part of the country, every generation, and I expect we'll return to this discussion in Quebec in 2 years or less, seeking to leave, you're going to be insecure about how long you're going to hold it together. So I think that you want to lay down the markers of where you're distinct and attempt to make much of those. So I think we have. Well, you know, Quebec is Quebec, and of course it doesn't need any help in that. But, you know, when people draw the map, some people think of the map of North America, there are great comparisons between, you know, would somebody in Alberta feel a greater kinship to someone in Texas than a Maritimer? That might be. You know, this is a heavily balkanized country, and I would say less so the United States because it has still most founding myths which sustain it.
Thank you. It was a very interesting speech, and I have to say, if I'm allowed a short comment, that I think I share your underlying view of the sympathy of the two peoples for each other, and this partly comes from, I should say, our heritage. My father and mine, although Canadian, goes back to American roots. But there's something you said about, you mentioned at one point that differences trace to history. And I would like, perhaps you could comment a little bit more on this and I'll explain what I mean. Because, in fact, Canada and the United States beside each other in sort of in many dimensions converging. But when you look at the history, Canada is I believe, the largest, most powerful country in the world that does not have a history of empire. And the Americans, of course, you referred to the American Empire, France, Britain, India, China. As America emerged in the world, it emerged sort of one of, like everybody else, like the leading powers in the world were empires. And Canada attempts to sit at the table with all of these current and former imperial powers. And there's something fundamental we don't really share. So there's a convergence in some of these issues are almost superficial, that being Canadian, though, like, and it is all through our school system and our schooling of who we are, that we never quite be the same. I don't know if you share that comment.
Are you saying we're at the table by virtue? We shouldn't be at the table because we haven't had a colonial empire?
No, I'm saying they enlarged the table to a size where we perhaps deserve the seat at it, but we don't share that history that all the others have. So we're quite unlike the others, and we're unlike the Americans as well. It's not a comment on whether we should be there or not.
Well, you know, we try very hard to... we weren't going to be at the table until the Second World War, when we were more than pulling our weight and emerged with the fourth largest military in the world and escorted half the shipping across the Atlantic and took a regular bombing run over Germany and of course, landed at Juno Beach. And so we were not going to be part of it, perhaps because we didn't have the gravitas of a power, but earned it, in a sense, earned it through our participation in that war. You could say World War I, too, but mainly that war. And then our very concerted effort we made to establish the infrastructure of the post-war period. The United Nations, NATO is very much a Canadian project. I mean, Lester Pearson called it his, you know, the most important thing he did. I just think that we didn't have that past, but certainly looked to, and we're going to be ignored, and were often ignored, and a lot of the time in Washington, our diplomats spent trying to get attention, because we were doing things and not being recognized for those, but I think we paid our dues, so to speak, punched above our weight, and by the time it came to creating those institutions, Canada was certainly going to be there. It wasn't, though, of course, till we nearly weren't in the G7 in the 70s, but the United States wanted us there. We actually didn't qualify, and I'm not so sure we'd qualify even today, for the economically speaking, for the G8 or the G. I think that there's probably these figures change, but in any case, I think that we try very hard to lay down markers and to earn our way into those institutions, and perhaps because we didn't have the weight and the history of other powers. It was more recently acquired, I guess.
What do you think is the biggest opportunity for Canada-US relations in the next 10 years?
Opportunity?
Yeah.
I would hope it would be, and I don't think it will be, but I hope it would be thinning the border. When I said, and I think Ambassador Jameson would agree, that it's harder to get from Dundas to Detroit than it is from Warsaw to Berlin, that's absolutely true. Europe is taking down its borders. It's the most astonishing thing. You can drive from Berlin to Prague now and not see a border, and go into Poland past that. We have done the opposite for reasons that are understandable. But I would hope we would be able to find something to follow the rest of the world into integrating or to erasing the border. I would like to see a border that people can cross and don't have to show passports and don't have to undergo the kind of questioning that we now have. And I understand it. I understand why this happened. But I'm hoping that the opportunity will be to take it down. I don't see it happening because the United States worries about security. Well, we worry about prosperity, and we have to find a way through this. And I know Ambassador Jacobson probably spends a lot of his time thinking about that, but I would hope that that is something that we can move toward, because it is astounding if you compare us and Europe on that very important thing.
Thank you.
Hi, good evening. Thank you. Great speech. A point that I, when you started your speech, I thought you might address, but unless I was not paying attention, you didn't. And that is environmental practices, both the reality and the perception. Have you any observations on how Canadians act and how they perceive themselves with respect to environmental issues vis-a-vis Americans?
Well, it's, you know, obviously there is an environmental movement here. It's not as developed as it is in Europe. The Green Party is polling at 8% now, or 10%. I don't think it'll win a seat. And we have seemed to have said to the United States, we'll follow you on some environmental practices. I'm not so sure that's the best idea. We obviously have a government which doesn't think that the oil sands, in the old parlance it was the tar sands, but the oil sands are a problem. And there are nations, and, you know, we go now to Denmark or to Copenhagen, and we were given a very rough ride there. So I think probably environmentally our image in the world has slipped enormously. And I think that could change with given the change in government. But I think Canadians individually think themselves, see themselves as quite environmentally conscious. We recycle, we do home, and we are getting into wind power and solar energy. But I think that the direction our government is showing now does not seem to be one that is open to international accords, whether it's Kyoto or Copenhagen, and that's maybe something of a where the government has become detached from people. But if you look at polls, Canadians feel themselves quite environmentally engaged. I don't see that reflected in public policy or foreign policy, for that matter.
If I could just ask a quick follow-up, would you feel that Canadians are feel themselves to be more engaged than Americans?
More engaged?
More engaged than Americans on environmental issues?
I don't know. I really don't know. I can't answer that. I just don't know if we are or not. We might be. Certainly, we feel passionately about national parks and the outdoors, but I don't know. Americans do about theirs, so I don't know, to be honest. Teddy Roosevelt, yes.
The question is about the White Rose Alliance Party in Alberta. Is that a similar like Alberta version of Tea Party? And the leader, Daniel Smith, is she a Sarah Palin, Canadian Sarah Palin, or the Australian Gillian Giffen?
Well, Daniel, she has a sense of humor, Daniel Smith, which I'm not so sure Sarah Palin does. No, I'm not worried about the Tea Party. She's actually, is it Danielle Smith, right? She actually, on social issues, is quite liberal. She's a fiscal hawk. I don't see a Tea Party in Alberta. Alberta's gone its own way that way. I don't see a Tea Party here. So if you're an Albertan, I wouldn't stay up too late worrying about that.
Hi. Thank you very much for your speech. You touched on many aspects of our convergence that are really complex issues of society. One of them that really caught my attention was the discussion about the death penalty. And I find that when we touch about subjects like that, we can often pick and choose kind of one level of detail on the matter. And I wanted to have your view on how you would compare the U.S. and Canada as to the level of incarceration rate. Because I know that I'm not too familiar with the situation in Canada, but I know that in the U.S., I mean, you have prison systems trading on the New York Stock Exchange, J.P. Morgan floating bonds for new prisons, and the prisons are really skyrocketing. And I think although the situation of the death penalty could be converging, maybe the incarceration rate is going really the opposite way. What's your view on that?
I don't have the rates in front of me, but this government is building prisons. The Globe and Mail wrote about this just a week ago. Prison construction is up a third or more in Canada. We are incarcerating. Now, that comes amid figures that our crime is falling. So is this a wedge issue the government thinks is useful to it? The levels of incarceration, I would assume, are still higher in the United States, but we are building prisons. I don't have those figures. Someone else might. But we are building prisons in Canada.
Okay.
But capital punishment, I think, is worth thinking about and looking at, because that's an interesting phenomenon that seems to be changing in the United States.
It's very interesting what you were saying about how we're diverging in many of the aspects that we often consider to be our Canadian identity. But if those aspects are diverging, what would you suggest as sort of what's left of the Canadian identity that's individual to us?
Well, I think that we should take pride in what we are and what we've built and not worry about defining ourselves in contradiction to the United States. That, and I was joking about peacekeeping, and I mean, we actually don't do peacekeeping the way we did. And hockey still remains something, and we still have a proud sense of the land and the charter. I just think that we should take confidence in the culture, the growth of Canadian literature, the arts in this country, the holding of the consensus in Canada that we're a moderate people, we believe in renewing ourselves through immigration, we believe in pluralism. I think we need to have a real debate about multiculturalism, but our doors are open, we are a welcoming country. We've done all these things. Our population is growing. There are countries which are suffering population losses because they are not open to immigration. Mm-hmm. I think we should examine who we are, understand that we've been here 144 years, that there was a reason we got here, that we should understand where we came from, teach our past, which we by and large don't do, and say to ourselves that it all adds up to something. There may not be that overarching theme, although I think it's moderation and consensus and social order and social justice. And this isn't to deny that other countries don't have them, but we have them. And we have them and have, I think, not perfected them, but improved them. And I think that we're here and we've lasted against considerable odds. And I think we should take great pleasure in that and not worry about it all the time. So perhaps that all adds up to something. I hope it does.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What a wonderful way to end the Q&A, Andrew, on that hopeful end. Stay right here on that hopeful note. I am here only to say an official thank you on behalf of the Mallory family and Dean Chris Manfredi, who is here this evening with us. But as is the tradition, and tradition is strong here at McGill and at the Institute, I'd like to ask Faisal, who is one of our brilliant McGill graduates, is now in law school and working with us at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, to deliver the formal thank you.
Thank you, Professor Maione. One of the advantages of being a McGill student, I feel, is often attracting intriguing and intellectual minds, such as yours, Professor Cohen, with whom we can engage in discussions, and I feel today was a special treat. So on behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I'd like to present you with a token of our appreciation.
Thank you very much.
We're also very grateful to have the presence of Mr. Ambassador David Jacobson. And so on behalf of the Institute, I'd like to thank you and give you a token of our appreciation as well.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you so much to our distinguished guests. Thank you so much to everyone who came to the lecture. We'd like to thank you all now by inviting you to a reception that will take place in the room just outside this one. Thank you so much. Good evening.